Blog Talk Radio.
Can't tell me life was meant to be like this. A black man in a world dominated by whiteness. Ever since the Declaration of Independence, we've been easily brainwashed by just one sentence. It goes, all men are created equal. That's why corrupt governments kill innocent people. With chemical warfare, they created crack and AIDS. Got the public thinking these were things that black folks made. And every time there's violence shown in the media, usually it's a black thing. So where are they leading you? To a world full of ignorance, hatred, and prejudice. TV and the news for years they fed you this foolish notion that blacks are all criminals, violent lowlifes, and then even animals. I'm telling the truth, so some suckers are fearing me, but I must do my part to combat the conspiracy. The SAT is not geared for the lower class, so why waste time even trying to pass? The educational system presumes you to fail. The next place is the corner, then after that, jail. You gotta understand that this has all been conspired to put a strain on our brains so that the strong grow tired. It even exists when you go to your church, cause up on the wall, a white Jesus lurks. They use your subconscious to control your will. They've done it for a while and developed a skill to make you want to kill even your own brother, man. Black against black, you see, it's part of their plan. They want to send us to war and they want to ban rap. What they really want to do is get rid of us black. Genocide is for real, and I hope that you're hearing me. You must be aware to combat the conspiracy.
In the art, business, industry.
Even in this rap game, all that glitters ain't gold. Now the rap is big business, the snakes got bold. They give you whack contracts and try to make you go pop, cause they have no regard for real hip-hop. They'll compare you to others and say, but yo, he sells. And you know in your heart that he's weak as hell. So you say, I ain't doing that corny stuff. But they tell you that your chart positions will go up. Sometimes they front big time and make you many promises. And then when they break them, that's when your mama says, son, you're making records, but that guy seems shady. It could be too late, and your career could be flaky. I hope you listen to the things that I'm sharing, see. We all have a job to combat the conspiracy.
Yes, welcome to another edition of Your World News, another episode of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon. Once again, I'll be joined by Andrea Zamudio in about a moment. She is the managing editor of yourworldnews.org. If you have not been there yet, please check us out. That's Your World News. That's yourworldnews.org. yourworldnews.org. Check us out. We have a blog section there, which is where Andrea Zamudio, she manages, and we've got a lot of great posts up there, some great videos, as well as some articles from some terrific, terrific, progressive, strong writers who are part of our fold. So and a lot of other miscellaneous stuff that we pick up throughout the web, and we post with people's permission. But check us out. We've got a really special show today, and this is not our typical time, as you know. Actually, we don't have a typical time, but do we broadcast live this early in the morning? And so I know some of you may be listening to this on archive, and in the comforts of your home or your office, in the afternoon or early evening. Right now, as I am speaking, this is a 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time show. And the reason why we're having this show is because we have a very special guest who will be joining us at about 15 minutes till the hour of 8 a.m. And that's Dr. Masoso Demko. And he'll be joining us. He's the former... he's a former president of the PAC, which is the Pan-Africanist Congress. He's a PAC, a current PAC rep in South Africa. He's done a number of strong things towards the liberation of Zania, otherwise known as South Africa. And you know, we're really fortunate to be able to have him on the show before he goes back to Joburg later today. So you know, he's been here working on some things, and we're going to talk to him about some of the political prisoners who are part of the Azanian People's Liberation Army, which was a the Azanian People's Liberation Army was the militant faction of the PAC, just like Mkhonto we Sizwe, otherwise known as MK, or Burning Spear. They were the military wing of the ANC, and so he'll be joining us in a few minutes. And you know, he'll be on for about 15 to 20 minutes. And then after that, Andre and I will be talking about a number of things regarding, you know, Libya and this current escalated onslaught by NATO forces. And we know the NATO forces are completely backed by the U.S., completely backed by the U.S. And, you know, it's not a good look for anybody in this case, you know. So we see the imperialists and the Euro-American imperialists really, you know, doing everything, you know, working in cahoots to, you know, balkanize and recolonize Africa. And no matter how many civilian lives are taken, you know, that's, you know, their end game is nothing short of regime change in Libya, and not for so-called civilian purposes or anything like that. And so, you know, it's really important that we tune in to this, you know, to alternative media to really find out what's going on, because CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, ABC, and they're not gonna give you the whole story. They're not gonna tell you about how these rebels in Libya are trying to kill as many Black Africans as they possibly can. Any Black African they find out there, they assume that they are a mercenary, and they use that as a pretext, a false pretext, to kill as many Black Africans as possible. And the mainstream media in the U.S. has not even touched this with a 10-foot pole. So, you know, Andre and I will be deconstructing that in a little while. So, Andre, you're on live, and wanted to, you know, once again have you greet our listeners and you know, tell us what's on your mind.
Hi, Solomon. Good morning to everyone. Hello?
Yes, you're here.
Okay. Yeah, it's great to be with you, and I'm really looking forward to this interview. I don't know much about the issue myself, but, you know, it's always great to have people who are on the front line so people can just talk with us and give us a perspective.
Definitely. Any thoughts on Libya so far in terms of this new information that has come out, you know, from NATO itself, saying that they are going to be there for at least another 3 months? We know that, you know, NATO forces and we've known that the CIA is on the ground there, but we know NATO forces now, since they've been meeting with Libyan rebels in Western Libya, and the footage has already come out, and we know Sister Cynthia McKinney, former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney, is on the ground in Libya now with a fact-finding delegation that includes Wayne Madsen. And you know, definitely check out yourworldnews.org in the blogs section for updates, because we've been posting the updates that have been coming out of Libya from that fact-finding delegation, and so there's a lot of information there. But Andre, I wanted to get your two cents on all of this, you know, dating back to March 19, when the U.S. you know, first started, you know, unloading indiscriminate missiles on the North African country of Libya.
Yeah, you know, I just find it interesting they keep pushing the deadline. It was supposed to just be a couple weeks. Then, you know, something would be resolved. Then supposedly the U.S. pulled out, and it was just NATO forces, but that doesn't really mean anything because the U.S. has so much control over NATO. So, and they're still not out either way. But And now, you know, he said it's 3 months. And on, you know, Friday, finally Congress, you know, stepped to Obama because this isn't even constitutional. So I'm glad that, you know, there's some kind of discussion about how it's, them being involved in Libya is completely unconstitutional, but we'll see if that really goes anywhere. And, you know, I read that he's supposed to provide the cost of the operation and the details of the mission within the next 14 days, but, you know, we'll see if that actually happens.
Right, and it's quite interesting. You wonder if this has to do with, the fact that it's such a bipartisan atmosphere in Washington. The reason why, you know, because most of the members that stepped to Obama are Republicans, you know, and Republicans who had no problem supporting war under the Bush regime, and you know, we know that they, you know, so it's always important to put those things in context because, you know, I'm glad to see that it's raising a specter of consciousness. But these guys are some of the most hypocritical guys and women who are some of the most hypocritical on the planet because I dare to think that if Bush was in office or McCain was in office and was doing this, that they would have the same kind of stance, but you know, at least it's happening. But it's always interesting to, you know, to see it. I think the root goes down to it is pure racism that they, you know, they just don't like the fact that there's a phenotypically brown skin or black skin man in the White House, and and they're doing everything to rebuff that. And you know, and people listen to the show, they know that we're no fans of the Barack Obama administration, including himself. You know, he's a warmonger, just like George Bush was, and you know, he has you know, has escalated the war that Bush started, and you know, Obama now owns the Afghan-Pakistan war because of his moves in terms of expanding it and spending more money militarily than Bush ever did. But yeah, it's always you know, I just wanted to chime in on that. It's always just interesting, you know, to see so many Republicans because it was predominantly the Republicans that went ahead and Andrea, I'm like, you know, I was thinking, you know, well, Bush didn't, you know, that you know, the Iraq War and then the Afghanistan War was never declared by Congress either. Where were their voices back in 2003?
Right.
Where were their voices back in late 2001? You know.
Right. Yeah, and it's interesting because Dennis Kucinich, the Democratic lawmaker, he proposed something on Wednesday, I think, and it was completely shut down.
Right.
But then on Friday, when the Republicans proposed it, and yeah, and you're definitely right. I just think that at least it's getting some kind of discussion going. But it's definitely a good point. Yeah, they, you know, Bush did the same thing, and nothing was said.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, Dennis Kucinich is one of those unique Democrats. He almost doesn't belong in the Democratic Party because he's been so forceful on important issues. You know, he's been an advocate for single payer. He's been against you know, war, you know, for a long time. You know, and so yeah, he's one of those unique Democrats that, you know, and we'll see. He may soon be Dennis Kucinich congressman from Washington State, depending on how things pan out in Ohio. So yeah, it's gonna be interesting to see. And later in the show, we're also gonna, you know, we also, before we can get the show started, like, you know, before our interview, we definitely should pay homage to the late great Geronimo Pratt, who died this past week at the age of 63 in Tanzania. And he was a former Black Panther. He did 27 years for a crime that there's clear evidence that he did not commit. And it's just interesting. This episode, we're talking about political prisoners as well. And you know, I want to make sure that we draw the connection to political prisoners here in the U.S., you know, and those that are working on freeing political prisoners that are warehoused here in the U.S., you know, such as Linda Peltier, the Cuba, Cuban Five, Marshall Eddie Conway, Mumia Abu-Jamal, you know, the Angolan Three. We just keep going on and on and on, and making sure that these experiences are merged, that those folks that work on those, you know, should definitely, you know, keep their eyes and ears and consciousness open to what's going on the ground in South Africa in terms of people's efforts to free these political prisoners who, you know, who are fighting, you know, to end apartheid in South Africa. And so, without further ado, I see that we have Dr. Tepko, who's on the phone right now. I'm going to welcome him. But as I said before, he's the Pan-Africanist. He's the PAC, which stands for Pan-Africanist Congress. He's the rep, the South African rep. He's a former president of PAC, and we feel really lucky to have him on our show. I'm very fortunate. So I'd like to welcome Dr. Tepko. Can you hear me?
Yeah, thank you very much, yes.
Yeah, so this is Solomon Kamajan and Andrea Zamudio, my co-host. We're both on the line right now, and we just want to welcome you live to Your World News, you know, broadcasting everywhere throughout the world. And I wanted to open up with a question, because I know I told our listeners that you'll soon be traveling to Joburg later today, we really want to thank you so much for spending a little bit of time with us before you travel. The first question I wanted to ask is, when you're looking at the Azanian People's Liberation Army, can you give us, actually, because a lot of our listeners may not know exactly what the Azanian People's Liberation Army was and how they functioned within the PAC. Could you give us a brief context of that?
Yes. After the Sharpeville uprising, which led to the massacre of a number of people, and then the Pan-Africanist Congress was banned, it was very clear that the apartheid colonialist regime could no longer be faced with just peaceful means, and therefore an army was formed, the guerrilla wing was formed, which was then called the Azanian People's Liberation Army. Throughout the struggle, that army at the Pan-Africanist Congress was recognized by the Organization of African Unity, as well as, of course, the United Nations itself, and then, of course, by a number of other countries throughout the world. And as you will remember, apartheid was declared a crime against humanity. So certainly they were fighting against this crime against humanity. But at the time of negotiation in 1994, a commission was appointed by Mr. Mandela and others, which was called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The strange thing about that commission is that it called everybody perpetrators, as well as those that were fighting against the crime of apartheid, to come to this commission and justify their activities. A number of the perpetrators of the regime were given amnesty, and a number of people that belonged to liberation movements like the Pan-Africanist Congress, for instance, are still rotting in the jails of South Africa. I campaigned for many years now, in fact, you know, since I returned home in 1995, nothing really has happened. And, of course, it is very strange that people who fought for self-determination, people who fought against the crime against humanity, should be the ones who have to answer why they did that. I found that very strange, and I'm sure a number of people will find that strange.
Right. Well, why do you think the APLA comrades are still imprisoned?
Why do I think so?
Yes.
Well, they took part in the armed struggle. They fought. And then, of course, people were killed on both sides. Our people were killed, and the other side, too, people were killed. That's what happens in war. But this was a war for liberation. It was a war for self-determination. It was a war to destroy a crime against humanity. A crime against humanity had been committed against the African people there. So these people were fighting against that.
Yes, very much so.
And then and of course you'll remember what happened at the Nuremberg situation after the Second World War. The Nazis were defeated and so on and so on. But none of the Allied soldiers appeared before the Nuremberg Commission to answer anything. I mean, it was very clear that they had fought against the Nazism, so why would they be brought there? And then I think that here, international law also was completely ignored to appease the forces of apartheid.
Right. And my other question, another question I had to ask you is, why do you think the Truth and Reconciliation Commission hasn't dealt with this matter, given the fact that, they let off the hook through this Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
I think that in truth, the Truth Commission was not a truthful commission talking about reconciliation. Because you cannot reconcile without justice, you cannot reconcile without looking at the very fact that apartheid was a crime against humanity. So I really think that the purpose of the commission was simply an appeasement to the very people that had committed the crime of apartheid. It was a commission to appease everybody that everything is okay and everybody can forgive. And everybody can reconcile. And then here you are having people who had power wanting to reconcile with people who had been weak without giving anything to them.
Right. And I believe, there are a lot of those white murderers, those, white invaders in South Africa, they got off after the Truth and Reconciliation, when they came forward, I believe the murderers of Steve Biko, did not end up serving any time. And so it seems very hypocritical and just strange, to say the least, that these APLA comrades are still in prison, 17 years later after the so-called end of apartheid.
In fact, I think that it is also curious that now that you have mentioned Steve Biko, it is really curious. We have never heard about who killed him, what happened to them.
Exactly, very, very much so. Can you discuss your request to President Jacob Zuma, President of South Africa, that they be pardoned, and where is that request sitting right now?
Well, let me give you a little bit of background here. President Mbeki was the president, and then this whole thing was going on, and then for years I campaigned that these people be released, and he finally said that another commission must be appointed. This commission was appointed, and, a few of these people are supposed to have been forgiven now. Let me say they are supposed to have been given amnesty. But a number of people who are on this list are the very perpetrators. Many of them are perpetrators of apartheid. Now, what has happened is that I understand that some white families, according to the constitution of the country, have questioned the amnesty. In other words, the president can forgive, but they can make representations that, the people should not be forgiven, which is actually very strange, because I had said that the TRC was weak. It had ignored the principles of international law, so the president had to use his presidential powers to give amnesty to those people. So in any case, even for those that are supposedly forgiven, they are still in jail pending, answering, hearing the complaints of the white people who say, well, our people were killed, these people were criminals, and so on and so on. And I think this also exposes the falsehood that the South African constitution is the best, because it is normally paraded as the best constitution in the world. I don't understand how a constitution that is best in the world can imprison people who fought for human rights. and people who fought for land, for self-determination, etc.
Right.
So to answer your question in brief, therefore, is that the situation has not changed. And that's why I had to write to President Zuma and say, President Zuma, this is the position. And, of course, anybody who is interested in that document is welcome to approach. I'm sure you can approach Nana and read it for yourself. And then if you want to discuss this issue further, we can discuss it when I'm there in Azania, South Africa.
Definitely. I think that's a good idea. I think I will approach
Then you will see the real problem there, the issues involved there, and why I've given 10 reasons why those people must be released immediately.
Exactly. My next question, Doctor, was despite the differences between the African National Congress and the Pan-Africanist Congress historically, do you feel that this campaign will generate mass support?
No, they have not, because they are the ones who negotiated. You'll remember that the negotiations actually began in 1985, secretly, with the ANC, with Mr. Mandela at the head, and nobody knew about these negotiations. And then when the negotiations finally took place, they were just a little bit ridiculous in that, okay, they were calling the fighters to come and confess their sins. And then also the land question was sacrificed. Nothing was done. The land question itself has not been resolved. So the ANC has not been very keen on this thing. I don't know the reason why. They've never said a word about those people that are in jail.
Right.
A few of their own people are there. A very few of them are there, but they've never said a word about it, and they've never said why they even put this thing for negotiations. I mean, for negotiations when they were negotiating with the South African apartheid regime.
That's very interesting. Very interesting, to say the least. Do you feel that the networks here in the U.S. and other places that support political prisoners such as Mumia Abu-Jamal, Marshall Eddie Conaway, Leonard Peltier, the Cuban Five, and we know there's so many other political prisoners here in the U.S., and most of which are black. Do you think that they should deal with this this question regarding the APLA comrades?
We'd be very much obliged if they do. I think it is very critical. I'm talking about people who have been sitting in jail now a little bit before 1994, so for nothing really. And some of these are young people, and some people are ministers there, they are presidents there, they hold high positions there because of the blood of those young people. And I think that it is unfair that the leaders gave orders, and now because they are comfortable in their positions, they just betrayed those young people there, and I think it is very unjust. We would be very appreciative. I think that even Geneva, I think if people like December 12th, I think they should raise this matter at the Geneva at the Commission on Human Rights. I think this coming September or coming February next year, Commission sits every year.
Right. One of the last questions I want to ask you is what can folks here that reside and also folks who are citizens of the United States, what can we do to help out with this campaign so that we can get these liberation fighters freed from prison?
I think there's been silence on it. Everybody has been saying everything is okay, everything went well. Nobody wants to talk about these fighters. So the publicity is very important so that people are informed as to what has happened. And I think there must be a demand also that if it is possible, letters must be written to the president or questions must be asked to people concerned in South Africa, the president in particular. Why are these people still in jail? And when are they being released? And their release is long overdue. It's almost 20 years now. And some
is there a way we
died. Some have died in jails. I mean, it's unfair.
Yeah, exactly. It's a crime in and of itself. Is there a way that we can stay in contact with you to continue to find out the updates and just to continue to let you know of whatever progress, you know, folks like myself and Andrea are trying to do here to raise the specific taxes around this issue.
Yeah, just repeat that. You say, is there what, sorry? You mean, where you can contact us?
Yeah, how can we go about contacting you to stay in touch with you to find out how things are going on the ground?
Yeah, you can, actually. You can, and you spoke to Nana, and she has got our email address. She has got our phone number. I can give you the phone number here, but the email, I'm sure you can get it from her. So, yes, you can get all the information you want, and if you want to ask further questions after this, we can give you any information you want. But I think it is critical that you get that 9-page letter that I've written to President Zuma.
Okay. When I get that from Nana, would you mind if I posted that on our website?
No, not at all. I think that it would be a good thing.
Okay. Yeah, we get quite a lot of hits on our website, on our blog.
Yeah.
And anything that you write, I mean, I will be emailing you, but anything that you write regarding this and that you want posted on our website, you know, you just email it to me and I'll make sure that Andrea and myself post that
okay.
We have tens of thousands of visitors.
Okay. I hope that Nana has your email, et cetera, so that, you know, or because I don't have it, you see. I don't have your email and so on. But if you give it to Nana, she gives it to me, definitely we'll send you any information that we think you should have. And there's a lot.
Okay.
Because, you know, there's been a lull, I think, in the States here. I think there's been a little bit of disconnection, and we have not been communicating with one another, you know, like in the past. I mean, you know, people don't really know what is happening there in many cases. And this is an opportunity, I think, to ignite that fire of people having information and so on.
That's so important, and that's something I wholeheartedly agree with you, is that we need to understand that our experiences here in this empire and the experiences that black people have in Azania, even to this day, are very, very important, that we understand that our liberation struggles are very similar. And before you leave, if you could just touch on, because a lot of people don't understand that still to this day, the vast majority of black Azanians do not own or control the majority of the land. It's still in the hands of mostly white people. Am I correct on that?
Yeah, I think you should familiarize yourself with the Constitution itself, particularly Section 25, Paragraph 7 of the Constitution. You see, after the wars of national resistance, the gun triumphed over the spears that we were using. Our weapons were inferior, and obviously the gun triumphed. And for the colonialists to consolidate their power, they passed a law called the Native Law Act of 1913, and that was on the 19th of June 1913. And that act allocated 7% of the land to the African people, who were majority, and they had 93% of the land. And then a commission was appointed. It was called Thompson Commission in 1916. It was not until 1936, 20 years later, that another 6% was added to that 7%. And that's what the African people have been allocated. So when these people were negotiating, what happened was that there's then this Section 25, Paragraph 7, that I want you to familiarize yourself with, which simply says that you cannot claim land that was taken from you before the 19th of June, 1913. Now, what land was that? That land is 87%. That 87%, you can't touch it. You can claim from the 13% if in some ways it was taken away, but certainly you can't touch 87%. That means, therefore, let me say also that this 13% is just rocky land, poor land, sandy land, there are no minerals, but the land that is fertile, the land that has all the minerals, this 87%, is in the hands of the minorities that speak to you. And the worst part of it, I've been a member of parliament, and the worst part of it, I have said, of course, that there should be no sale of land until the land question is resolved. But you get people who come there, they buy land left and right. A lot of white people come there and they're buying land left and right, while the people themselves have nothing. So the land is also being sold, and I've said there must be a law to stop that. There must be a moratorium so that land is not sold to anybody outside. But the whites are selling that land like West.
Right. Is the ANC doing anything to anything progressive to address this land issue? Because they're the ones that have been in power.
I don't think they could do anything progressive when you realize that the land question was already betrayed at the beginning. So they came up with things like selling, a willing buyer, willing seller. Those things don't work because, okay, now if a certain the white man says, okay, I'm selling land, I want 2 million. The land maybe is worth 2 million. And the guy says, no, I want 4 million. So that willing buyer, willing seller doesn't work because the more you want to buy, the more they inflate the price so that it is impossible to buy. And in any case, why should we buy the land of our forefathers which was taken from us with guns? Why should we?
Exactly.
Everybody always says that we are expropriating land from whites. Where did they get the land from? The land is ours. The land belongs to the African people. We can't go to Europe and then some people say, we say the land is ours and expropriate it. The Africans can never expropriate land because it is their property which was stolen from them and taken from them by guns.
Yes. Exactly right. You're exactly right. I'm speechless. I'm with anger because I totally agree, and I hope our listeners spread this amongst their communities and brother, if there's anything that we can do in the future to help out, we definitely will, and you'll continue to stay in our thoughts and minds because we see you as nothing less than our brothers. We're separated by is a large mass of water and some land, but
we are one people, my brother, and we have a common destiny.
Yes, yes, so much so. So I know you have to get ready and you have to leave for the airport in about a half hour. But I thank you so much for coming on and giving us some valuable information and knowledge. And really, more importantly, starting the forming a strong solidarity bond between ourselves, Your World News, and yourself, and the good people on the ground in Azania. And so I believe this is the start of a very important relationship between us and yourself and other liberation-minded comrades on the ground in Azania. So I just want to thank you so much for coming on our show though today.
Thank you very much, my brother, and have a good day.
And all right, you too. Safe travels.
Thank you very much.
So, Andrea, that was a very informative interview, to say the least. And I'm speechless. That's why it's so important to have guests on like that. Like Dr. Tefko, to really put things in a broad perspective. I had known that the vast majority of the land, which as he said, the land, the original owners of that land are the black Azanians. I had known that the white minority that stole, whose ancestors stole that land by gunpoint. Control the vast majority of that land, arable land, fertile land, so forth. But one of the things that I learned in this interview was Section 35 of the South African Constitution that to me is a huge crime in and of itself that would actually that component would actually be that explicit within the Constitution, which makes it so much more difficult for Native Azanians, you know, to reclaim the land that's rightfully theirs. And as he said, they shouldn't have to purchase it back. It's their rightful land, you know, and so without a doubt, that's an aspect of that Constitution that must be changed. It must be changed, you know, if there is to be any kind of justice whatsoever, that aspect of the Constitution in Section 35 must be completely revamped. I wish them the best of luck. And beyond that, you know, I will commit myself, and I know, Andre, you will too. As a member of Your World News, that we'll commit ourselves to continue to make this this issue as big as we possibly can, given, you know, the capacity we have with yourworldnews.org and continue to build with that brother and his comrades, so that hopefully also that the APLA comrades will be free, and also that you know, hopefully someday in our lifetime we'll actually see you know, justice in South Africa, where you know, so many Native South Africans, so many Native Azanians, who are impoverished right now because of the residual effects of colonization, the residual effects of you know, apartheid, and the hundreds of years of exploitation by white Europeans in that country will come to an end, and our brothers and sisters on the ground in Azania, as well as in so many other places within the continent of Africa and even beyond, you know, we'll see justice. Any comments on that interview, Andrea?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that a lot of the things that he discussed are prime examples of what institutional racism means. I feel like that word is thrown out there a lot, or those two words are thrown out there a lot, and people you know, it's kind of just like something that people want to avoid and not really think about. What does that really mean? And so I think that having a provision in the Constitution where it specifically privileges one group of people to take advantage of another group of people, that's institutional racism. The fact where black Africans in South Africa are disadvantaged in terms of getting their land back is huge. Or just, you know, how he was talking about how these brothers and sisters are still in jail as political prisoners, but white people who were martyrs were not investigated at all. You know, like you were saying, the people, he was saying that the murderers of Steve Biko, there has been no progress on that, like who killed them, what happened, no one's in jail for that. And so how is that, you know, why are there those differences? And that's institutional racism. And it's you know, we talk about it occurring in the United States all the time, but it's something that isn't definitely not limited to the United States. You know, it happens everywhere. And that's far more dangerous than someone calling you a name or not liking you because of the way you look. Those types of things affect people's lives for generations. Things that are imposed legally, you know, can change the structure of an entire country for a specific group of people forever.
Right, right. And it seems, I mean, you correct me if I'm wrong, it seems, but, you know, it seems that one of the common threads throughout that has been this European domination that has continued to rear its ugly head. So even when colonization ended, you know, when colonization and apartheid ended, whether it was in South Africa or other parts of the world, it seems that you know, when they still have, when you have these like white minorities that still have such great power and influence over the vast majority of indigenous people within that land. And that means that those people continue to live impoverished, continue to have the worst schools, you know, very little access to even things like running water. It's it is absolutely a shame. It is a high crime to the ilk. It just truly is. There are so many South Africans, still to this day have to walk some way beyond where their house is actually located to get water, to pay for the water and then to bring it back in jugs and buckets, where so many white South Africans, they don't have this issue whatsoever. They have the best access to the best healthcare facilities, the best schools, and food and so forth. And it's we see it here as well. And we know that this land right here was Indigenous Americans, Native Americans. Land, from coast to coast, and from north to south. This was all their land, and you see those people are pushed off onto reservations to this day, and it's just ironic in a way that this was their land, and it was stolen from them, and that they now are the ones who live in basically squalid camps, called reservations, while so many white Americans live in the lap of luxury and have access to so many things that Indigenous Americans don't, and we see that going on in South Africa. And so it's a question that this is an issue that the ANC and Jacob Zuma himself are going to have to address sooner rather than later. It should have been addressed a long time ago. Matter of fact, going back to Mandela and Mbeki, this is something that should have been addressed, because what is the sense of ending apartheid, which was, a crime against humanity in and of itself, the past laws and the murders, of Biko, and that's what the TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation, Andrea, people, white South Africans literally got up in front of the TRC and they admitted to various crimes. And that was one of the components of the TRC. They were able to, they confessed of their crimes, the things that they did, and were able to get off pretty much scot-free. But what's the use of making that such progress in terms of the liberation struggle to end apartheid, which was a victory, but in the same token, it's not a fulfilled victory. It's not a complete victory when these just disproportionalities, these social disproportionalities still exist, where the vast, that's like African Americans who are 13% of the U.S. population, controlling 85%, 87%, 90% of the most fertile and arable land in the U.S. Can you imagine that? What white folks would do. It's something that the ANC and Zuma, they have to address soon. Because otherwise, it's clearly. There's a lot of folks have rightfully so, in my estimation, criticized them for not fulfilling what they said that they were going to fulfill. If the people supported them, time and time again at the election polls. Andre, I want to play this clip, and I want to get your initial reaction before I even give a reaction. I want you to give and this is since we're on the topic of Jacob Zuma, and let's put that in context with Libya. And I want to play this clip from Black Agenda Report. It was Glenn Ford. A couple weeks ago, and I want to play this, and I want Andrea, you to give your initial reaction and thoughts and comments to this. So on the other side, we'll hear Andrea's comments on this. But everybody, listening, including myself, listen very closely to this. This is a really interesting commentary by Glenn Ford.
As far as the United States and Europe are concerned, Africans have nothing to say about what happens in Africa. South African President Jacob Zuma made a second trip to Libya this week, on behalf of the African Union, seeking a diplomatic end to NATO's war against Muammar Gaddafi's government. Just as with a previous African Union peacekeeping mission back in early April, Colonel Gaddafi agreed to the peace plan. And just as before, the so-called rebels and their American and European bosses refused to even consider a ceasefire. As has been obvious from the beginning of this humanitarian farce, the Great White Fathers of Europe and the Wall Street mascot from the United States, as Obama has been called, will be satisfied with nothing less than regime change in Libya, and to hell with what Africans think. The Euro-Americans will soon prove just as contemptuous of their erstwhile North African Arab allies, based in Benghazi, who claim to be leading a revolution against Gaddafi. But these rebels lost their legitimacy the second they decided to become the ground troops for a neo-colonial invasion of North Africa. Revolutionaries fight the power. The gang from Benghazi are mere pawns of imperialism and have no credibility whatsoever as revolutionaries. This is an imperialist war fought for imperial objectives. The rebels have chosen to become imperialism's mascots, waiting like pitiful Gunga Dins for the British and French to arrive with attack helicopters to burn and kill their countrymen. NATO orders their Libyan minions around like children. NATO recently issued instructions that the rebels not move beyond certain points in the desert so as not to enter the killing fields that the rich white fathers, plus Obama, are preparing to incinerate Libyan government soldiers. Naturally, the rebels will do exactly as they are told, since this is not their revolution. Rather, Libya is the front line of the European and American counter-revolution. The chain of command reaches to Paris, London, and Washington. Benghazi has reverted to the colonial outpost that it was when the Italians ruled. Only now, in the 21st century, all of the Europeans, plus the Americans, get to lord it over the Libyans, who grin and skin while thanking the colonizers for coming back to save Africa from the Africans. And so it makes perfect sense that a peace proposal from the president of South Africa, Black Africa's most powerful and wealthy country, acting on behalf of the organization that includes every nation on the continent, counts for less than nothing in the imperial scheme of things. The West encourages South African President Jacob Zuma to help bring chaotic black countries into line, but Zuma and the African Union are not authorized to interfere with imperial wars on the continent. That's white folks' business. When the Western attack helicopters arrive, the Benghazi-based rebels will cheer as if they won something. The Gunga Dins should carefully study those helicopters and their awesome firepower, because those guns will one day likely be turned against them. The U.S. and Europe have no intention of allowing Libyans to rule Libya. And after all, why should the imperialists hand over all that oil to a bunch of local flunkies who couldn't even fight their own war? For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
Andre, your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, Glenn Ford just broke it down. Like, it's crazy that from the beginning it was seen, or it was not seen, it was portrayed as a humanitarian intervention. And if it wasn't clear then to a lot of people, it should be clear now, because it's all about regime change. They don't want Gaddafi in their period. You know, if you bomb his home and you're trying to take him out, that's not no fly zone to protect civilians. When you're bombing schools and hospitals and you're killing civilians, it's not about a no fly zone to protect civilians from the leader. It's specifically to get him out. But you know, he explained it so well in terms of this isn't really a revolution that people, when they talk about the rebels, and you see this in the news in the United States, and they're like, oh, look at, you know, all these people, the rebels are fighting for their country. But behind that is completely the U.S. support in terms of arms, in terms of training, everything. So, you know, it's just, it can't be clearer than that. And I think that, you know, recently how Russia came out and stated that they would no longer supply ammunition or weapons or any type of training to the rebels, you know, that's a big statement, and I think it says a lot. And there is, you know, a lot of disagreement even within some of the European nations into them realizing, some of them, even though they should have from the beginning, but at this point being like, okay, this isn't at all about humanitarian intervention. It's completely about business and corporations' interest in the country.
What are your thoughts on, I mean, even beyond that, these rebels, it's no secret now. As we know, Andre, and I kind of touched on that before, before our interview with Dr. Tepco, the fact that these rebels that the U.S. is supporting, I mean, for God's sakes, you know, we saw a couple of days ago, William Hague, who is the foreign minister of Great Britain, he touched down and was meeting with the rebels themselves in Benghazi and went there to you know, tell them, you know, that they continue to have Great Britain support. We also saw John McCain. He flew in there several weeks ago and, you know, touched down and has issued the same support. What's interesting, though, Andrea, is these rebels that the U.S. is clearly backing. I mean, you know, they own that responsibility now. The U.S. is clearly backing, along with so many, you know, a few European nations. These rebels are systematically killing and have been killing and massacring Africans, black Africans. They've been massacring them. And, you know, have you heard anywhere in the mainstream media, CNN, MSNBC, ABC, and also the white nationalist station, what's that called, Fox, yeah, the white nationalist station, Fox. Have you heard anywhere within these mainstream corporate news, corporate media, I should say, corporate media entities, any talk of the complexion of these folks that are being massacred, and then also even before that, that the rebels are, you know, massacring people themselves. Have you heard anything about that, Andre? And if not, why do you think that's not the case?
No, not at all. You know, I mean, they're not concerned with exposing what's actually happening in Libya, because it would be showing people in the United States just the truth about how the United States runs its foreign policy. It's never about protecting people in other countries. It's not about democracy. It's not about freedom. It's about corporate interests in the United States. So if they were to show that what these rebels are actually doing, then, you know, people would start to see what's actually happening. It's not in their best interest to show that, especially when they're backing the rebels. You know, if it's the other side, then of course they, you know, it just go off on whoever else is committing some kind of crime and make it seem like, you know, it's this and the other. But in reality, half the time the United States is doing far worse than that on whoever they're supporting. So that's, you know, they're not going to show that. But then the obvious, like, racism that's in it, they're not going to discuss the difference between the black Libyans or other black Africans in Libya and how they're treated and the issues with them, because they just don't care.
That brings us also to the other hypocrisy. I want people to tune in to what I'm about to say. Another important tidbit of news, which is not and I say that facetiously when I say tidbit, because it's a major piece of news that should be dissected in every civics and social studies class in America, whether it's middle school, high school, and even in colleges. We know that's not it's not going to be, but it should. It should be. What I'm about to say, that the hypocrisy of America is one of the most disgusting things I would say known to man, and it needs to be called out. And it's only disgusting because so many people believe in American democracy, believe that America is the beacon of light for freedom and justice and equality worldwide, that they stand for this, that, and the other. But once again, Andrea, just as in last year and the year before, this year the U.S. has come out that they are going to abstain. They are abstaining and not going to attend the UN conference on racism, which this year is supposed to be held at the UN headquarters in New York City. It's just amazing that they're not going to attend the UN conference on racism. And this goes all the way back to when the UN conference on racism was held in Durban, South Africa. They did not attend that, but then you see this black president come in, and you think that surely a phenotypically brown-skinned president, is surely he's going to send a delegation to this conference. And what did he do last year? Nope. What does he say this year? Nope. All right. And what that does is that when the U.S. refuses to send a delegation, what that does is say we're not going to address. All right, we're not going to address what we know exists, and of course, they're not going to say that we know institutional racism exists. But institutional racism exists and is as strong in the U.S. as it is in any nation that has institutional racism woven into its society. It is woven into U.S. society. It is woven into U.S. society, and these hypocrites that are in Congress, both sides of Congress, have the audacity to come forth and say, "Oh, we're not gonna attend because it has an anti-Semitism element." It doesn't have an anti. And first of all, they throw that bullshit out there, anti-Semitism. You know what I'm saying? What the hell is anti-Semitism? So does that mean that because we don't agree with what Israel is doing to Palestinians, does that mean that all of a sudden we're anti-Jewish? We hate all Jewish people? No, we hate what's going on. What is the state of Israel is doing to Palestinians? The native land of Palestinians. Okay, so those white Jews that are Israeli citizens that want to talk about that, that wasn't their ancestral land. Their ancestral land is somewhere in Eastern Europe or Central Europe. Okay. That's where their ancestral land is. The original Hebrews, as we know, were brown-skinned, to say the least. But beyond that, to move away from the biblical mythology and all that stuff, because sometimes it serves as a red herring, to get down to the whole anti-Semitism thing, people have to realize that Semitic, there are a number of languages and that fall under the Semitic languages. Amharic happens to be a Semitic language. So, but they love to throw that out there. Oh, you say anything, against what Israel is doing, and oh my gosh, you're anti-Semitic. So in this case, when people want to address Zionism, which in its roots of Zionism, and going back to the founder of Zionism, Theodore Herzl, and its roots are inextricably racist. Zionism roots are racist. You can't parade around somebody, and I've seen these people that parade around and say, "I'm a progressive Zionist." How can you be a progressive Zionist? You can't be a progressive Zionist, because fundamentally, when you look at the roots of Zionism, it is rooted in the theft of land from Palestinians. So if you want to be progressive Zionist, then you renounce the term Zionism. You renounce your association as being a Zionist first and foremost. You deal with that first, and then we can start to have a more constructive conversation. But as long as you address yourself as a progressive Zionist and attach that label as a Zionist to yourself, There's nothing progressive about you. That's like a white slave owner masquerading around as a Christian. All right, you know. So if you're a Christian, you know, and you look at you know some of the fundamental tenets of Christianity. If someone is Christian, you know, if someone is Christian and they believe in Christianity and so forth, it would appear that being an owner of human beings and owning them like cattle, and whipping them and killing them and murdering them and lynching them, it would appear that you can't masquerade around as being a Christian and a slave owner at the same time. And that goes for Zionism. And so because the Zionism question is raised, Andrea, the U.S., which doesn't give a damn about justice or anything, the U.S. is a bunch of hypocrites. Those people in Capitol Hill, you know, they're a bunch of damn hypocrites. And the society itself within the U.S. has to be revamped because it is a hypocritical, contradictory society. You know what I'm saying? You either stand for justice or you don't. So you make the tough decision. So if your buddy over here is doing bad things, doing evil things, all right, then you renounce yourself from what they're doing, and you call them out. You call them out. But you know what? It's because of the money factor. All right. So how much money and influence does the Israel lobby have within Washington? How much does that have? And then we look at how much the Israel lobby, the likes of AIPAC, you know, J Street, how much the Israel lobby has in Washington, D.C., and has on the political structure within the United States of America. That's where we'll see why the U.S. will go ahead and you know, speak with a forked tongue. And one token say we're for justice, but at the same time support an injustice and an oppressive apartheid regime in Israel. Any thoughts on this continuing development, Andrea, where the U.S. once again has said that they are will not be attending the World Conference Against Racism?
It's not surprising. But it is enraging. But when you see how, you know, for example, Obama responded to the verdict of Sean Bell by telling people, you know, not to riot and that justice had taken its course, you know that he, and I mean a number of other things, but that being a small example, he's not interested in addressing issues of race. He's interested in pleasing, you know, his corporate masters. He's not concerned about what's happening in black communities or, you know, you were talking about how apartheid South Africa, you know, it hasn't changed that much. And so that really made me think about the United States and how things don't just change because a law is passed. So, you know, we're talking about the law in the Constitution there and how it needs to be changed, and it definitely does. But that the work doesn't end there because you see desegregation happen in the United States, but schools are still really segregated, almost as much as before desegregation, and they're certainly not equal, you know. So you see all these disparities in the schools where white schools have, you know, the latest technology, and you see in black and brown schools they don't even have enough books, or you have books that are completely outdated, or there's asbestos in the building. And so it doesn't really stop with these laws, but they won't even start with even addressing the issues. They won't, you know, them not going to the conference, like I said, it's not surprising because on a smaller level in the United States, they won't even address the issues that are occurring now. They won't talk about police brutality, whether it's in regards to policy or in the media. You don't see that being discussed. You don't see it, you know, and you know these things happen every day. Every week somebody gets shot, like a black man gets shot. Something happens, and there's no discussion of, like, why is this happening consistently. It's not, like, something, you know, an individual separate case. And so, yeah, you know, it's it's said. I think it's just reflective of the state of this country right now. And to go back to Libya, I know that, and you're talking about Zionism, one of the articles that we posted on our blog from Cynthia McKinney, she's discussing about how a lot of the conditions for civilians in Western Libya is really similar to that of Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. And she specifically references it. She thinks that, you know, this might have a lot to do with how with the Israeli lobby in the United States and them trying to dictate and push the United States into how they should handle the situation. And so it's interesting, you know, that now you're starting to see a similar pattern there.
Definitely. This is just, and we know the U.S. is not alone. You know, they're joined by Israel and Canada, who have joined them in abstaining from this year's conference. And it's so laughable, the propaganda campaign around this. Around Zionism and protecting Israel's crimes. It's so amazing. I mean, to me, it's honestly, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, it's analogous to, you know, someone knowing, you know, that their, you know, that their buddy, you know, brutally murdered somebody, you know, in cold blood, you know, brutally murdered them and then doing everything that they can to cover that up, to cover that brutal murder. And that friend turning into a serial killer, and that friend is on the rampage, and you know that your friend is a serial killer. Now, do you the right thing and you know, do what you can to stop and end this madness and bring them to justice, so that they can, you know, face justice, you know, or do you continue to go out there in the public eye, not even just be silent, and just say, "Hey, I'm just not going to snitch on my friend," but to be to actually go forth and actually speak effusively about your friend, and then to support. Oh well, you know, they did such and such, but we support, and we'll always be on the side of Israel. I mean, that's exactly what they're doing. And but I guess, you know what, Andrea? And the deeper question is, like, you know, the deeper question is, will we really expect? So in this case, though, the friend is a serial killer himself. So why would they call out the crimes of their serial killer friends when they're a serial killer themselves? You know, and so. And what I say about that, if you look at the bloodshed that has gone on unjustly within the U.S., you know, from, you know, police brutality and police officers and the institution of policing in America not being revamped, not having some kind of justice for police officers who go rogue and kill unarmed men. And unarmed 70-year-old black girls in Detroit, Michigan. I mean, you know, would we really expect? Do we really expect the U.S. to go on its own, and fess up to the crimes that Israel is committing right now, and to say we're no longer going to support them? I think that we probably can't. That's a bit much to expect the U.S. And the only way that's going to happen is that if there's healthy pressure put on the U.S. by a critical mass of people within its borders to demand justice, not just at home but abroad. I mean, that's the only time that we're gonna start to see a changing. They have to be pressured. They have to know that, I mean, completely pressured in a number of ways. You know, civil disobedience. You know, not funding campaigns. You know, not, you know, supporting politicians and political parties that whatever. That are part of this, starting a real, you know, and supporting, like, strong, progressive, you know, third parties. That's the only time that's going to happen. But that's not going to happen without a critical mass being informed blatantly about what this is. Not euphemizing things and watering things down. No, it has to be put out there blatantly. And so that's the only time that we can expect to potentially see something. And when it starts here, when the people, you know, demand that here, then we will see justice abroad, because we'll see that it will be like a domino effect where, you know, U.S. wars of imperialism will be demanded by the people in the U.S. that they are stopped. Of course, you see people in Pakistan, as we saw yesterday and we saw on Friday, people in Pakistan lining up by the thousands, protesting the manless drone strikes and demanding an end from manless drone strikes that the U.S. has launched in Pakistan that have killed untold amount of civilians there, as well as in Afghanistan. Yes, we see them protest because it's affecting them. But the people here in the U.S. have to demand that. They have to be partners in justice and humanity with their brothers and sisters in Pakistan and Afghanistan and Iraq, and demand it here. That's the only way that people in those parts of the world will have justice there. People have to see them as their brothers and sisters, and you have to put yourself in their shoes. What the bloody hell would you want the rest of the world to do if some country was dropping manless drones up, you know, in your town, in your city, in your village? You would want the people of that country to demand that their government stop that bloody hell, that bloody reign of terror, which is going on. So it's, you know, but you know, so let's turn the focus a little bit, since we're talking about life or death. Once again, Andre, I want to get your feedback on this. I'm gonna play this bar clip. You know, I want us to take the show out with this. But so on the other end, Andre, I really want to get your feedback on this, because it does have so much to do with justice and humanity. And in a country like the U.S., where anywhere between 28,000 to 44,000 people a year have been dying year after year because of lack of health care, this piece is right on time. And there are so many things that we can't allow to be pushed off of our front burners. They must all remain on our front burners and not on our back burners. And this is as well.
President Obama is even slicker than Slick Willie Clinton when it comes to pulling the rug out from under poor people while pretending to be their champion. Obama sent his Justice Department lawyers before the U.S. Supreme Court to file a friend of the court brief in a dispute over Medicaid. Medicaid recipients had sued the state of California for making such deep cuts in the program that health care providers were refusing to serve Medicaid patients. The plaintiffs claimed the state was violating federal law, which calls for state Medicaid rates to be sufficient to enlist enough providers so that sick recipients can find doctors, hospitals, and pharmacies willing to treat them. Many states pay so little for Medicaid that very few doctors will serve recipients. The California Medicaid recipients said that federal law trumps state law, and that the state had no right to water down Medicaid to the point that healthcare providers wouldn't touch the program. That would amount to depriving recipients of equal access to care under the federal Medicaid law. And according to the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution, federal law has the last word. Normally, one would expect a Democratic president to side with the supremacy of federal law. But not Barack Obama, not this time, not if it empowers poor people. The administration found a slick way to take the state's right side of the issue, arguing that there was no explicit federal law that allowed private citizens to sue states to enforce the standards of care called for under federal Medicaid law. In other words, the administration argued, as did the state of California, that recipients can't sue for their rights unless the law specifically authorizes them to sue. But the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals disagreed. If states are too stingy with their payments, Medicaid recipients and health care providers could sue as a constitutional right for enforcement of the federal law. Later this year, we'll see how the U.S. Supreme Court rules. But the Obama administration and its constitutional lawyer-in-chief have been revealed as states' writers when it allows them to cut the budgets of poor people's programs. It's easy to see what Obama's up to. Rather than permit Medicaid recipients to sue, he'd allow the states to keep whacking away at the rates paid to doctors and hospitals, even if it means that people are denied needed care. Then Obama can claim that Medicaid costs are going down on his watch. Of course, this will do nothing to fix Medicaid. All that will happen is that sick people are made to go without medical care. Obama is exposed once again as a sneakier version of the Republicans. The GOP lets everyone know that it hates Medicaid and wants to do away with it. Obama claims he wants to protect people's health care rights and will use the powers of the federal government to achieve those rights. Then he turns around and tries to deny Medicaid recipients access to federal law and the right to sue. Democrats in Congress are upset with their president and plan to file their own brief, one that upholds the supremacy of federal law and citizens' rights under the law. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
Andre, I'll let you have the first stab at this one. Your reaction?
Yeah, I mean, that's outrageous that the White House would have lawyers trying to prevent people from you know, suing the government for their right to health care. And just the whole issue that this is even occurring is just outrageous, and I think that people don't see it as outrageous in the United States because they're just used to having to pay for absolutely everything, even though our tax rate is high. It might not be as high as other countries, especially you know, European countries, but it's still high. And then, but you don't receive a proportional, you know, social services in return. You know, in Poland and a number of other countries, Norway, this. The university is free. They have free health care. Like, it's not even an issue of, like, oh, you know, the left thinks this, the right thinks that. It's just like, okay, we're going to be humane. Like, and, you know, there's disagreement on other things, but that's just a humane thing to do. And in the United States, it's just like people don't even see that as something that it should be just a basic human right. And so now it's crazy that now they, you know, people have to sue the government to try to get Medicaid. I mean, it's outrageous.
It's disgusting. It's disgusting. Yeah. It's vile. It's reprehensible. And yeah, people get so much more for their tax dollars in other countries. And I wish Americans would freaking get this, you know, through their thick skulls. I mean, but it's going to take some time for Americans to, you know, some effort on the part of Americans to actually dig their heads out of their asses and stop sucking up to Americanism as if it's a, you know, what makes you a real patriot is if you can actually criticize your you know, your government to create a better society for all. And Americans are not willing to do that. They're not willing to take a step back and say, you know what, let me look at this and what I should be receiving in return for my tax dollars and what other people should be getting in return for their tax dollars. Look at the high rate of taxes that are paid in other countries, you know, 50%+. But then you look at what they get in return. You look what every single human being gets in return in those countries. You know, free health care is the tip of the iceberg and undoubtedly probably the most important because it has the ability to sustain life, you know, and prevent people from going in debt. I mean, you know, the number one reason people file for bankruptcy in the U.S. is because of health care bills. But beyond that, you know, you mentioned Poland. You know, that was the first, you know, European country they mentioned. I mean, in Poland, they have students there get access to free higher education, free college, free universities, completely free. This is paid for by the state. This is paid for by the state, and the same goes for Norway and so forth. But
We even look with the educational reform that we've seen in places like Venezuela. They now have universal tertiary education. They also have universal health care. And their government has said, hey, what we're going to do is we're going to pay for this. We're going to use 60% of our oil revenue money to pay for social programs like health care and literacy programs and programs to make people literate so that they know the Constitution. I mean, can you imagine if most Americans actually knew about the U.S. Constitution?
That's necessarily good things, but I think it's important that Americans know about the their Constitution, or I don't want to say maybe not their Constitution, but the Constitution of these these white men who are called the founding fathers, but really they were slave owners and land usurpers and so forth. But if Americans knew the hypocrisies that lie within that tainted piece of paper, the Constitution, you know, maybe they would do like other countries are doing and revamp the Constitution to represent all people today, as we saw. We've seen in Kenya, we've seen in Venezuela. I mean, we've seen in Bolivia where the Constitution has been revamped, you know, and those aspects of the Constitution that before only benefited mainly white individuals and those who had the most wealth, those constitutions were revamped to encompass everybody. And, you know, so Americans have to get their heads out of their asses and realize, I mean, they're getting screwed royally. And at the same time, defending the people that are screwing them the hardest. You know, the people that are screwing them the hardest are the ones that they defend. They defend most vigorously. And it's sick, you know. And it's not just Republicans that they're defending, but who are screwing them. But it's also, yes, the likes of Barack Obama and so many Democrats that are screwing them as well. I mean, that's like one of the biggest masquerades is that, you know, they have these Democrats who are supposed to be these, you know, social change agents. I mean, that give me a bloody break.
Right.
So we got a couple minutes left. Any last? Got me all fired up. We started this journey at 7:30 a.m. And for all of you that are listening to this on archive, we started this journey at 7:30 a.m. on a Sunday morning, and we're ending at 9 a.m. on a Sunday morning. But I'm you know, fired up now. I don't know about you, Andre, but I'm fired up. I was gonna maybe take a little nap, but I'm fired up. I feel like I need to write something, and I think I will, write something that soon will be posted on Your World News. But as we always say, if you want to get involved with Your World News, you know, you can contact myself or Andrea. Andrea's email is andrea@yourworldnews.org. My email is solo@yourworldnews.org. If you want to get involved, you want to write, post something. You know, Andrea is our managing editor, so, you know, she'll look it over and then subsequently post it. But, Andrea, do you have anything else to say, especially since you are managing editor, anything that you want to say in regards to that?
It's really important, like you said, that in any capacity that we can, we do what we can to inform each other and to start building with each other and organizing. And so, you know, that's what the purpose of this media collective is. And so, you know, I just hope that this is reaching people and that it brings a different perspective to people to start thinking about and start talking about with their family, changing their own perspective, because it really starts with yourself and then with your family, and then you trying to connect with other people to build something productive, because you can't wait for things to change. The government's never going to create laws that are just. They have to be forced to do them through us, you know, threatening their economic and political power.
Right. And with that last word, great last words, Andrea, I totally agree. going to let Gil Scott-Heron take us out, and this song is dedicated to our brothers and sisters, our Zanian brothers and sisters, the original name for South Africa, not the unoriginal name that was given to Zania by unoriginal Europeans who said, oh, this is a southern part of Africa. Let's call this South Africa. This is to our Zanian brothers and sisters. This is dedicated to you. This is Gil Scott-Heron. What's the word? Johannesburg. Refuse the word.